Hello and welcome back to the Goodness Lover Show. Today we're joined by Dr. Jason Horalak, PhD and ND, to talk about prebiotics and how they can influence immunity, your mood, your metabolism, and so much more. This call was so insightful and I'm excited to share it with you. Let's dive in.
Dr. Jason Horalak, you are a guru, a well-known person in the space that a lot of people refer to, and you've got over 20 years of experience with the microbiome. So we've been actually waiting to have you on the show for a very long time. So it's very exciting for us. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. It's great. Great to be here. I always love chatting about gut health with people who are passionate about health and gut health specifically.
Awesome. Very humble. Well, we wanted to talk to you today about prebiotics. And this is, I guess, in the consumer world, a little bit of a new thing. But to you guys that have been studying this for 20 years, it's not so new. For those that have just maybe heard of the term for the first time, can you just explain to us what is a prebiotic and how is it maybe different to a probiotic?
Yeah, because I think you're right that whilst there may have been tools that I've been reading about and using for 20 years in practice, but I still recall, I can go back to when I did my naturopathic training, which finished in 1999, we did almost nothing on prebiotics as part of that. Yeah, we covered probiotics in a decent amount of detail as much as they were doing in those courses back then. But it's really when I started delving into it from my honors degree and then PhD, it's going, what are these things, prebiotics? What's lactulose? Never heard of lactulose. I've never heard of, fructose oligosaccharides or galactooligosaccharides, which are three of the main sort of prebiotics that we use in clinical practice. So for even for me at that point, it was a major learning curve. You're like, I don't know what these things are. You delve into it. Oh, a prebiotic is a selectively fermented substance that encourages the growth of beneficial bacteria and a selected range of beneficial bacteria that has health enhancing effects on the host who consumes them. I think that's probably the clearest definition. So there's a few aspects of that. So they essentially, they're not digested or absorbed. Yeah, so we eat them, they don't get broken down, they reach the colon, they're then fermented, but only selectively so. So only a few species of bacteria have got the right machinery to break those down. And they can ferment them. And then their population goes up because they're getting a selective food source. And then we get flow-on benefits from that because they're beneficial species, essentially. And we get more of their metabolic byproducts as well. And because they can also, through that fermentation process, create these things called short chain fatty acids. We increase the amount of that, and that lowers the pH in the colon, which is actually a good thing because most pathogenic bacteria are sensitive to pH and like growing in a more neutral environment. So if we make it more acidic, we're actually discouraging the growth of pathogenic bacteria, or even what we might call pathobionts, which are species that are problematic when in high amount, but they're okay when they're in the right amount, and further encouraging the growth of beneficial bacteria, most of which like growing in a more acidic environment. You know, so we get that sort of general flow-on effect from prebiotics. But I think the term is often misused as just being anything that's a fiber is a prebiotic, and that's not correct. I mean, I think fibers, wide diversity of dietary fiber in your diet and to be consumed in your diet is fantastic, and helps create a wide diversity of microbes in your ecosystem. But it's the selectivity of prebiotics that makes them different. So when we eat a prebiotic like lactulose, for example, we feed a limited number of species like Fecalobacterium, like Bifidobacteria, Lactobacilli in higher amounts, and Akkermansia, for example. Those four are the ones that tend to go up. Pretty exclusively, actually, in the vast, vast majority of patients. And we also have a decrease in levels of species that are more problematic, more pro-inflammatory, like Proteobacteria and Bacteroides, for example, with their consumption. You know, now, differentiating that from probiotics, which is going back to your original question, was like probiotics are live bacteria that when consumed have health benefits on the host. You know, so what prebiotics are doing is they're really encouraging your own indigenous population and your ecosystem to be healthier, versus a probiotic is a supplementary live bacteria that is a temporary resident of your gut, but then has health consequences when it's consumed and for potentially duration afterwards. But prebiotics are really encouraging your own individual unique microbes of your ecosystem. Because I think sometimes we forget that your ecosystem is unique. And just like your fingerprints are unique, your ecosystem is. So your strains of bifidobacteria are different from other people's strains of bifidobacteria. And taking one in a supplement doesn't really can't necessarily replace your indigenous populations. And what I like about prebiotics is they are encouraging your own bifidobacteria strains to become more dominant in that ecosystem, your own Fecalibacterium strain to become more dominant.
Well, if you weren't convinced that Jason's the guru, I think in that first opening, your belief is there right now. So someone's like, okay, cool. I want to increase these and I want to support this population within my gut. Yeah. What do I eat then? Like, how do I, is there anything that I can do to actually impact, by increasing prebiotic foods or whatever, certain activities? What tell us more about that.
Yeah. So prebiotics, you can either do essentially as a supplement or as foods. And we're lucky that a lot of foodstuffs that we have access to contain decent amounts of prebiotic compounds. And I look at what are technically referred to as inulin type fructans, which are also more commonly known as fructooligosaccharides or FOS. And I might just use FOS because it's much easier to say from this point on moving into the future. Now, FOS comes in very high levels in onions and garlic and Jerusalem artichokes, which commonly hold fartichokes, because of their content of FOS. Yeah, because it's indigestible, it reaches the colon, feeds beneficial bacteria, but they do increase gas. And that's probably the main side effect that's consistent across prebiotics in general. Like, there's the odd exceptions, some are a little bit more prone to causing gas than others, but in general, they all enhance gas production. Yeah. So we can eat more, make sure we're having onions and garlic, Jerusalem artichokes, globe artichokes, and certain foodstuffs that used to be part of our diet as, people from a European background, but less so now. And that would be things like burdock root or dandelion root, that used to be like, oh, it's springtime, we'll go harvest our dandelions, or it's autumn, moving into winter, we'll harvest our burdock roots, which are quite high in England, in fact. Mm-hmm. And same with dandelion roots and dandelion leaves, but because they taste bitter, Western taste buds are like, whoa, don't want to go near anything bitter, sadly. Chicory root, and even that chicory beverage that we have is actually quite high in Indian type fructans. And there are some more sort of lesser consumed foods like jicama roots and yacons, Peruvian ground apples, that are also really high in England type fructans. And yacons grow really well. They even grow here in Tassie, but they grow even better as you move your way further north from Tasmania. And they grow these lovely big tubers that you just peel and you can just slice, and they've got the amazing crispiness, but they're really, I think it's like 10 or 15% England. So it's very easy to get a therapeutic dose. And jicama root, as you often find in more Asian grocers, because they're, again, you can grow them in warmer parts of Australia, but they're not commonly grown. But you're eating this lovely big tuber of a leguminous plant, which is somewhat unique. But again, really nice to slice up raw because they've got that sweetness. Because inulin type fructans are quite sweet. Yeah. Now, with things like dandelion, there's all these other bitter factors that kind of override that sweetness to make them slightly less pleasant for Western taste buds. But, it was something that we generally consumed a fair bit of. And the other probably category of foodstuffs that contain a good amount of prebiotic compounds are legumes. So legumes contain, in general, good amounts of galacto-oligosaccharides. So that's slightly different than the fructo-oligosaccharides, which are made up of sort of branching fructose molecules attached in a way that our digestive system can't get at them. And with galacto-oligosaccharides, it's galactose sugars that are kind of joined in a way that we can't break apart. And again, it reaches the colon, feeds bifidobacteria and Fecalibacterium more specifically when it comes to galacto-oligosaccharides. But it's really legumes. There's small amounts in beets, beetroot, and small amounts in like sunflower seeds and pepitas and some broccoli cauliflower type family foods as well. But legumes are really the powerhouse, and by eating, a cup of legumes per day, you can actually get a therapeutic dose of those galacto-oligosaccharides in. And I mean, I've got a particular love of legumes because you're getting that lovely source of protein. You're getting those oligosaccharides, you're getting resistant starches, you're getting polyphenols if you're using black legumes or red skin legumes, for example, and other soluble fibers. So really as a single food that can nurture the ecosystem in many different ways, it's hard to beat legumes.
Well, that is fantastic news because I do love my legumes, all of them. I don't discriminate. So I think it would be awesome to talk a little bit more about, I guess, the benefits of feeding our bacteria via prebiotics. So you mentioned before the call that there's a strong connection to immunity, which everyone obviously is more interested in at the moment. Could you tell us a little bit about how that works?
Yeah. And I think some of the research was done probably initially on probiotics and immunity initially and showing that that and there is good research that's flowed on from that in the last 15, 20 years showing that ingestion of probiotics, there's some strains that are more probably more effective than others, but in general can up your non-specific immune response, you know, protect you against getting respiratory tract infections and reduce their duration. I think there's like a Cochrane review in, I think it was 2015, that found that I think there was a 47% reduction in respiratory tract infections for people taking probiotics daily, and a 1.89 day reduction in symptoms. So that's nearly 2 days less when you're taking a probiotic. So that's pretty substantial. And the good thing about that kind of immunity is that it's your body's, it's not like, it only protects you against one or two different types of invading organisms. It ramps up that non-specific immunity that's just at the ready to protect you against any kind of virus or any kind of bacteria that you're actually exposed to. You know, so I think there's that research that came out first, and it's certainly, you know, continuing to build upon that, which is why there's a number of studies looking at the potential of probiotics for COVID, you know, prevention and treatment, for example, most of which, as far as I'm aware, haven't actually come through with clinical trial results yet, but they're in the offing. But then there was research on prebiotics. And the first study I found was using, looking at fructooligosaccharides. And it was as a supplement and it was given to toddlers. And toddler age group is a fantastic group to study because they get sick a lot. And toddler age kids, particularly going to daycare, you know, and this is what the study population did, like they get sick like 10 to 12 times a year versus an adult, it might be 2 to 4, you know? So it's much easier to see a change when they get sick that often. So, you know, even a 50% reduction is like really noticeable, but going from 2 to 1, less noticeable in adults. So they often choose that population because it's much easier to see changes in. And there was about a 50% reduction in respiratory tract infections, giving 1 teaspoon of FOSS per day. You know, and this stuff, it tastes like white sugar. It's like amazing. It tastes like cotton candy, actually. It's really easy to give kids. You know, you don't get compliance issues with 99.9% of kids, or the occasional kid's too sweet for their taste buds, but most we're quite happy to take it. And, you know, I've had parents who they're just blown away because their kid was going to daycare, getting sick every week, and their parent can't go to work because their kids are sick, and it has a huge impact on their life. And every time they just get better, they get sick again. You know, it's driving them mad. And they see them and like, okay, well, let's just take this one thing. Not changing anything else in your diet, not doing anything else in your routine, just giving 1 teaspoon a day of FOSS. And they come back months later going, it's a miracle. I can't believe this white sugar had such an impact. Like, they're just not getting sick anymore. You know, and when that study first came out, which I think was in the mid 2000s, it became like the mainstay of my immune practice, particularly for kids, but even for other age groups as well, because it just worked so well, you know, and it still is. And I think there's another study looking at that kind of age group as well, showing again similar results of decreased fevers, decreased antibiotic usage, decreased, I think, like 90% reduction in lost daycare days. So they didn't miss many days of daycare versus kids in the placebo. So like a massive reduction, and all the flow-on effects of that is the parents can work. You know, they can make money. All those other things that go with when your kid's sick, you know, never mind just the fact that they're sick and it's mostly inconvenience when it comes to respiratory tract infection, typically. So you can see all those other flow-on effects that come from that. You know, and so for me, it's been a mainstay of my practice really since that time, and it has maintained that way. And there are certainly with adults, I'll use herbs like echinacea or andrographis and, you know, Tulsi basil and guiducci, for example, to enhance immune response. But I still go back to using prebiotics as a core part of that. And with kids, it's mostly just that, because it's such an inexpensive, effective option. You know, you can give one tub of FOSS you might buy for $12 and it does you for 3 months. You know, so it's very inexpensive, compliance-wise, easy and effective.
Incredible. Man, I wish we had that when we were in Bali. We lived with two kids that were at daycare, and just like I we don't have children, so this was their first experience of the kids getting sick, and they'd come home, one would have it, then one by one all the adults would like fall, and then the kid would get better, back to daycare, get sick again, and we'd all again. I've never been as sick in my entire life as that year we lived with those children.
But I could imagine.
So is it just the fructooligosaccharides that have been linked to immune function, or is it are there more prebiotics?
I would say the FOSS has probably got the best research in the area, but there is some research on galactooligosaccharides as a supplement as well. And I think the study I can think of was looking at older adults. I think they were 55 or above, and they weren't looking at infection rates. They're looking at impacts on immunity. And they found that by giving them a supplementation, I think it was 5.5 grams of GOS per day, there is an improvement in non-specific immunity and a decrease in inflammatory markers. body wide, which is also a benefit, because I think when we're looking at you know, again, relevant for now, it seems to be like that hyper immune response that's involved with severe COVID versus mild COVID that has these very high inflammatory markers, like things like interleukin 6 or tumor necrosis factor alpha. And the research on GOS in this age group was like they decrease those two parameters specifically, but enhancing non-specific immunity, which should flow on to improved infection resilience as well. But I don't think the research has necessarily gone through to that stage. So I still prefer using Linfos mostly, although I will still use GOS or a combination thereof. And then the other prebiotic that I really like is lactulose, which we can't get as a food source. Unlike the other two, you can take as supplements or as food. Lactulose is a semi-synthetic version of lactose, where they've essentially boiled lactose and it changes the configuration of the bond, so it's non-digestible to everybody, whereas lactose is arguably non-digestible to 80% of the adult world's population, but is to some Northern Europeans who have essentially a genetic defect that allows them to break down that lactose, whereas lactose is essentially indigestible to everybody. So it reaches the colon, again, very selectively fermented. There's not so much immune data that I've seen around lactulose, so it's probably not the one I would use most in that area. I mean, it should be helpful given it has a similar effect on the microbiota as inulin foss, but without the clinical trials, I will stick to using the ones that have got the higher quality data and keep using lactulose for the changes in the ecosystem that it induces, you know, because it's quite potent capacity to increase levels of beneficial bacteria and to decrease levels of pathogens in the gut. I'd argue even more so than GOS or FOSS, but it doesn't have the data on immunity as of yet.
Very interesting. Thank you.
I guess I'm just trying to get my head around this because it just seems so so bizarre to me that something that like a prebiotic can have such a huge impact on the immune system. Is the mechanism behind this well understood? Like, is it something that's really emerged in recent years, or it's something that we still don't fully understand?
I'd say that you might argue we don't fully understand. You know, that there are postulated mechanisms there, and part of that is obviously to do with that shift. Probably the core aspect is that shift in balance, is that when we increase bifidobacteria, increase Fecalibacterium, we tend to decrease levels of pathogens and pathobionts, we alter how the microbiota interacts with the immune system. You know, like, you know, 85% or so of your immune cells are in your gut. So the capacity of microbes to interact with your broader immune system is actually quite substantial. And if we change the composition of that ecosystem, then we're actually changing how that interaction plays out. And we're taking away a core pro-inflammatory driver. You know, those proteobacteria, for example, which are a classic group of pro-inflammatory bacteria in the gut, when their population goes down, that essentially takes away a lot of inflammatory stimulus that your body would otherwise have to deal with.
Interesting. So fascinating. And so outside of foods, is there any specific, has any studies been done on lifestyle factors, exercise or meditation? I don't know. Is there any sort of intriguing things that have seen that?
While we're on the topic of immunity
right, and also just, the positive impact on our microbes, you know, because I think people will be thinking, I'll just need to take a supplement, but they're not thinking about the, you know, that holistic picture of themselves. So I'd be interested to see what you've discovered in that area.
Yeah. And I think you're right that, and I'd rather people just take a prebiotic rather than not, but I think it's better if you can do, you know, change your diet, you know, and I think, again, if we're looking at a healthier microbiota composition, we're looking at diversity of microbes and how do we get the best, most diverse ecosystem. We eat diversity of whole plant foods, diversity of fibers, diversity of those color compounds in plants called polyphenols. That's really the best way of increasing the level of beneficial bacteria as well as the diversity of that ecosystem. You know, so I think that predominantly plant-based Mediterranean style diet is really key here for promoting the healthiest microbiota composition possible and for balancing out that pro-inflammatory, anti-inflammatory components of the ecosystem, because I think that's a good way of looking at the gut, and certainly that's the way I do when I do a microbiota analysis. We're looking, okay, what species are pro-inflammatory, which ones are anti-inflammatory, which ones kind of go in the middle, but can be pro-inflammatory if there's too much, or can be anti if they're in the right amount. So you're looking at that and go, how do we adjust that? And, you know, yes, prebiotics are a component of that, and in some patients who are more resistant to dietary change or have other disease processes going on that make dietary changes really tricky, because of symptom flares or something, then we might, you know, work with prebiotics, you know, more gently to start with, et cetera. But the whole aim there is, and I think in an ideal situation, yes, we want to work on that diversity of the diet more whole foods, avoiding processed foods altogether. You know, lots of nuts, seeds, fruit, veg, legumes, you know, whole grains, I think are key, even though they're often demonized in some parts of the blogosphere at the moment. Like fruits and legumes and whole grains, for example, I think are often demonized in certain circles. But from a microbiota perspective, legumes and whole grains are actually really good for microbiota composition. Fruit, fantastic for gut health as well. Mm-hmm. You know, and yes, while isolated fructose is problematic from a blood sugar perspective and a microbiota perspective, fruit containing an equal amount of fructose is not, and actually encourages the growth of beneficial bacteria. So sometimes we get really reductionist, oh, fructose is bad, therefore fruit is bad. It's like, no, it's not like that. So I think it's really trying to get around some of that mythology that's out there around those foods and encourage our patients to eat those things again. And yes, sometimes people have got issues with gluten, fair enough, and there's a certain proportion that definitely do. So you know, maybe gluten-free whole grains are the goer in a decent proportion of people, for example. And I think there is research looking at that, you know, Mediterranean-style diets being protective against depression and a range of cancers and cardiovascular disease, and even I think, you know, a range of autoimmune diseases as well. So I think that is kind of like a core strategy that's protective from a whole range of different things to do. And yes, I think there's good data around in moderate amounts of exercise helping improve immunity, you know, and this that is an area that I spent too much time going into, just trying to keep up with the microbiota, prebiotic, probiotic research is enough to fill my every single minute of every single day. But there is good research on, like, you know, exercising moderately reduces your risk of developing COVID and severe COVID, for example. Mm-hmm. Eating Mediterranean diet protects yourself from developing COVID based on the data that we have, you know, and people aren't talking about those other factors, sadly, as much as what they should be at the moment. Other things you can do to keep yourself healthy and your immune system working well, and other things like vitamin D status and zinc status are other things which, a little bit outside the question, but I think that need to be considered when we're looking at optimal immunity, you know, because many of us are stuck inside all the time. Some like me live very far from the equator, so we can't make vitamin D for 6 months of the year. And if we're lucky enough to escape, like I did up to North Queensland and soak it up for a month, then I could store up enough to get me through the winter, hopefully, to spring. Like now I can get out there and get some sun again and make some vitamin D.
Yeah. Awesome. Great tips. Thank you. So I can just imagine like someone's getting excited about prebiotics, but they're like fructo, what? They're trying to write it all down. Yeah. But is there any tips, I guess, as to how someone would actually purchase some of this if they've never even heard these words? Like, where do I find this? Like, how do I purchase, I guess, if they're going down the supplement route to start off with?
Yeah, it's a good point. And I think because they're not widely discussed and there's not even that many products around them comparatively, like you look at the range of probiotics that are out there, huge and ever growing. Prebiotics, they're growing slowly, but the amount of the space they take up on a typical pharmacy or health food shop would be pretty minor. Pharmacies probably don't have them at all, I would say. And the occasional and health food shops might have inulin Foss, like a good naturopathic dispensary will have, you know, a whole range of from lactulose to fructooligosaccharides to galactooligosaccharides to partially hydrolyzed guar gum, which are probably the key prebiotics that I would use in practice and have a good research base around them. Like our naturopathic dispensary here in Hobart has a wide range of two different types of galactooligosaccharides and a couple of different types of lactulose and different size containers, etc. You know, we're pretty fine tuned in that way. And there's even different types of Foss from short chain to long chain to short chain to in between combinations that are more nuanced usage that, again, we've got the whole range, but that would be more rare. So you might have to ask your health food shop to, you know, especially order it in, or you look online for, you know, I know there's suppliers like More Life up in Southeast Queensland that will sell kilogram bags of fructooligosaccharides, for example, as ways of getting it, you know, so that's certainly a possibility as well. And I mean, the only caveat there, as I mentioned before, is just the gas factor. So just beware. And my general rule with prebiotics is start low and go slow.
Yeah.
So maybe the therapeutic dose is 1 teaspoon. Well, start off with 1/2 teaspoon a day for the first week. And then if it seems good, then go to the full teaspoon a day for that point onwards. And there is a dose response. You get better shifts in ecosystem composition with higher doses in general with prebiotics. But you don't generally want to start with higher doses because you're going to get a lot more gas-related symptoms. But you start low, your body tends to adapt. You know, so yes, your flattest level will go up for the first week, and then it tends to peak and go back down. Then you can go up to a higher dose, it'll peak a bit, and then it'll go back down with that. So I think that just keep in mind, go start low, go slow. So some people might start with a quarter teaspoon, and it's like, yeah, it's totally fine. Whereas others can easily start with a teaspoon without any issue at all, maybe a slight increase in flattus. But if you do have issues with bloating or distension or pain or cramping with them, then it really means there's something wrong with your gut, and you should get that sorted, is what I would suggest. It doesn't mean there's something wrong with those things. It means that there's something imbalanced in your gut that's not allowing your body to deal with the gas that's being produced properly. And that can be things like SIBO, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. It can be constipation, slow transit time. And it can be visceral hypersensitivity, where your gut's, the nerves in your gut are hypersensitive. So even a small amount of gas causes pain. And if you increase that gas production, they're like, oh, I feel horrible pain from that. And yeah, you can blame that, or you can blame legumes from a dietary perspective, but why are you getting symptoms from that when you should just be farting more? Really, that's what's supposed to happen when we have these sort of gas-forming oligosaccharides, is just let out more flatus, particularly when we're first getting used to it. So I think it really means you should see a practitioner and delve into why you're getting those symptoms, because it does flag that there's something wrong with your gut. It's not behaving the way that it's supposed to. Mm-hmm. And I should flag too, there's an increase in flatus, but it's usually less smelly. So that's a good takeaway.
That's a good thing. I can just imagine all the conversations people going to health food shops going, I need to get some, I'll come back, right, I'll get the notes from the Goodness Level podcast.
They're just pulling up the podcast, like, again, trying to write down, I need to get this, can you listen?
Yeah, fructo-oligosaccharides.
awesome,
thank you.
So before the show, you also mentioned some really exciting research around mood, and I'm very interested in that, so I would love to pick your brain on why prebiotics are important for mood.
Yeah, I think it is a very exciting area, you know, and I think it again goes back to when we're starting to look at the gut microbiota having far-reaching tendrils outside the gut into other areas like the nervous system and how your brain functions. Yeah, and you would have said that 15 years ago, people would have gone, nah, you're crazy. There's not that connection there. But then you get research, like I think there was a 2016 paper where they took, you know, fecal matter from depressed people, gave it to rats, and those rats become depressed, you know, and it's just like, you know, pretty mind-blowing that we can actually shift that. And there's even isolated case reports of fecal microbial transplants to treat something like C. diff. They got a fecal transplant from someone who was obese, and then that person becomes obese despite no change in diet, no change in lifestyle, no change in exercise. You know, that backs up that kind of animal research. So, you know, there's data around the importance of changing the microbiota and the repercussions of that. But yeah, looking at that, at the gut stuff, or the brain-gut connection, is probably more recent around that. And that kind of model showing that, okay, we change the microbiota, we change the brain, has really led to an expansion of research around probiotics for mood and prebiotics for mood as well. And looking at the microbiota composition of, you know, depressed, anxious people versus healthy controls. And there's certainly still early days in the data collection here, because as I mentioned before, everyone's ecosystem is so unique that when you have a study with just 30 people in it, it's really hard to see patterns, because everyone's ecosystem is so different to begin with. It's only when you start including hundreds or even thousands of patients that you start really seeing patterns from with specific disease states more clearly. Yeah. So it's kind of like early days, we're seeing things build up, but some research has certainly shown higher levels of proteobacteria, which is that pro-inflammatory group of bacteria that I mentioned before, and people who are depressed and anxious. And that's important because proteobacteria, they grow something called endotoxin. Just like we grow hair, we grow nails, they grow endotoxin. And they're not doing it to make us unwell specifically, but it does. They release that because they're constantly breeding up and dying. And when they die, they kind of release that endotoxin, and about 80% of their cell wall is endotoxin. And that gets absorbed. And that actually changes the inflammatory milieu in the entire body. Your whole inflammatory level goes up a notch. With more endotoxin in your system, the more your inflammation goes up. Endotoxin damaged your blood-brain barrier, and they even change the neurotransmitters your brain produces, because it causes neural inflammation. Yeah. Like it's pretty amazing stuff. Like there's some fantastic research where they took happy, healthy people, gave them a dose of endotoxin, and for 4 or 5 hours afterwards, they are anxious and depressed. Yeah, just this acute response, people who were happy and healthy before that. And yet we've got people, due to dietary choices and potentially lifestyle factors as well, have this chronic absorption of endotoxins happening 24 hours a day, and then higher amounts after certain meals, for example, and that floods their system, or after even alcohol use too, you get a flood of endotoxins hitting your whole body and your brain after that. And that changes, you know, your mood, and it causes that inflamed, low-level systemic inflammation. Your body is constantly at this kind of low-level inflammation, which we now see as a core component of obesity and type 2 diabetes and metabolic syndrome. You know, the same things we see as risk factors for COVID too, for that matter, is this sort of low-grade chronic inflammation that's kind of there body-wide. But yes, so the endotoxemia is what it's referred to, and the low-grade endotoxemia is called metabolic endotoxemia, is immensely common in people eating Western diet, which again is correlated with high rates of depression and anxiety compared to a whole food Mediterranean style diet that protects you against developing depression and anxiety. You know, so there's a lot of data around that. Plus there's research on prebiotics for decreasing immune response and a stress response, so that, you know, it will decrease that morning cortisol, for example, when we take galactose-oligosaccharides daily. Galactose-oligosaccharides have also been shown to decrease anxiety as well when taken in larger amounts, around the 5 to 6 grams per day mark, decreases anxiety scores in patients too. You know, so there's hard clinical trial data. There's, you know, good data around, you know, changing the ecosystem to reduce levels of pro-inflammatory species, increase levels of gut healing, body-wide anti-inflammatory species too, because I think we have to remember that, and I linked this before around the composition of the ecosystem really determines whether you're getting an inflammatory driver from your gut ecosystem or anti-inflammatory drivers. And we take prebiotics where we shift that balance. We're getting more of the anti-inflammatory drivers from species like bifidobacteria, species like Faecalibacterium, and that pans out in essentially a less potent stress response to an external stressor. And it pans out in terms of potentially changing our neurotransmitters as well, because we're taking away those stress or those systemic inflammatory compounds like the endotoxins, which we know actually can change the way that tryptophan gets shunted in your brain. So it doesn't go into becoming serotonin. It gets shunted down to another pathway called kynurenine pathway, which doesn't make the happy compound serotonin.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow. Fascinating. Fascinating stuff. I feel like you've dropped so many bombs in that I just want to keep like, where can we go? There's so many interesting things.
Man, but so my pumpkin seeds I'm eating every day, and I think I'm getting with tryptophan. And then,
if you're inflamed, it's not going to become serotonin.
Yeah.
But yes, very interesting stuff. Thank you for sharing. I guess I would like to know, as you are the expert, the key expert in all this stuff, what does your prebiotic routine look like personally?
Yeah, for me, I try to do as much as I can through diet. So I eat Mediterranean style, predominantly plant-based, lots of legumes, lots of whole grains, lots of fruit, you know, and in summer, even more fruit. I quite like the summer bounty that comes with that. But in terms of prebiotic, so, you know, I'm trying to get a lot of microbiome nurturing stuff through my diet when I can. Lots of onions and garlic on a daily basis. And when I can get things like yacon or jicama roots, then I will get those or grow those. Sadly, I lost my yacon tubers in my garden, so I'm a bit sad about that. But soon I've got some growing in, to harvest in the future. So it's okay. We'll get there. And then I would take a teaspoon of inulin foss, or probably 2 teaspoons a day. And then partially hydrolyzed guar gum is probably the other prebiotic that would be part of my regular routine because of its capacity to nurture butyrate producing species, you know. But I'm trying to do a lot of that through diet anyway. So that's legumes and that's resistant starches, you know. So I might make a mixture of red rice, brown rice and black rice for dinner, for example. I'll let it cool, then have that as a rice salad that day or the next day. And we know in that cooling process, we actually increase the amount of resistant starch. And resistant starch is resistant to our digestive processes and feeds those butyrate-producing species in our gut quite selectively. Your cooked and cooled pasta does the same. So, again, you'll have some beautiful gluten-free pasta. Again, I eat that the next day when it's cold. Roasted root vegetables. Again, I'll eat a lot of this stuff the next day cold. So I do eat some eating food too, but I like trying to optimize the microbiome modifying potential of my diet when I can. But the PHDG is a bit of a, you know, just extra coverage to make sure those butyrate producers are being well nurtured. But inulin phos, I think, is really one of the, or lactulose has been in and out of my regime over times, but at the moment I'm into inulin phos, just for that daily dose because of the immune aspect to it, you know, because I've got kids who do bring home more illnesses than what I'd like, you know, and that tends to shorten their duration of it getting it too, and minimizes the infection rates they get, but then it helps protect me too, because yeah. I don't like getting sick. It means I can't do the things I need to do, which is frustrating. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I really like that. I like that your dietary optimizations, because it's just like, okay, we know that, you know, whole like brown rice would be good for your microbiome. How about instead of just having one type, have three different like black, red, brown, and then in top of that, how about we have it cold? Yeah. So it's just like these optimizations without making it too difficult. So that's great.
Yeah, really, it's not that much work to have three types of rice rather than one. Yeah. Same amount of work required to make it, and letting it cool is pretty easy. You just have to be more prepped for it, then let it cool down, and then, you know, adjust your taste buds a bit too, to enjoy sort of the more a cool rice dish rather than a hot rice dish.
Right.
Love interesting. I remember talking to the CSIRO, one of the people on that panel that did all that microbiome research, and they were just talking about this whole how food today is just so well, you know, cooked and prepared, but it's really just lacking that ability to reach our colon, like our friends in our colon. So it's just so fascinating. Hey, is there any other aspects of, you wouldn't want to be eating things like constantly raw or like
stale bread all the time.
Stale bread. Like that's basically, that was commonplace not that long ago, but now we just don't eat like that anymore. And it's having a huge impact. So is there any other aspects, a little secret cold versions of food that you use?
Yeah. I mean, I think I've covered probably the most of them. The other one I'd tag on that would be oats though. In that if you do soaked oats versus cooked oats, like if you just soak your oats overnight and eat them the next morning, you get much higher in resistant starch. But when you cook the porridge, the oats, they kind of split open that cellulose protective pocket, and you don't get nearly as much resistant starch from it. And even from a blood sugar regulation perspective, like soaked oats is so much better for regulating blood sugar. And that if I have porridge, for example, like 2 hours later, I'm shaky from, which is weird because I don't get that from any other food, just porridge. But soaked oats, I totally do not. And I could go for like 5 or 6 hours on the same amount of oats that were soaked instead of cooked. And that just is demonstrating the difference between having more of that starch is resistant versus the starch, you know, is easily accessible to us. But the human cells of ours just grabs it and soaks it up really quickly, then the blood sugar kind of drops down more quickly. So I think that's the other thing that's simple for people to do. And they can even warm it up. If they're really not keen on having cool oats, they can warm it up to around body temperature, and that will split open those oats in the same way as a high cooking process will.
Right.
That is so fascinating.
Matt, sorry, I was kind of laughing at Matt's face because he is like really into what you're saying now. He's like,
I'm in all that blood sugar stuff.
Because and we have like oats most days. So it would like if there's room to optimize them, then we'll do that. That's great.
Yeah.
Matt's like, whoa.
Whoa.
You should try and see what impact it has. Like for me, it was a pretty, like I could distinctly notice a difference between cooked oats and soaked oats. And I won't go near cooked oats now because the after effects on my blood sugar are so poor. And I don't get that from if I have a bit of organic sourdough bread or something like that, whole grain stuff, my blood sugar is totally fine. But something about that cooked oats that really is not good for me. And I've had another patient in similar boats, but soaked oats, totally fine.
Interesting. Yeah, great.
So connecting it with mood though, I mean, like now that we're on this blood sugar regulation thing, that's a huge impact on mental health that people probably don't realize. Can you explain more about that in terms of the microbiome? Like what's happening, like, you know, in our guts when we have something that can spike our blood sugar like that?
Well, I would say there's probably a lack of data around what's happening with the microbiota, I'd say in that situation. And even looking at the impact of things like sugar that's been widely demonized as being bad for the gut, there hasn't been nearly as many studies on that as you'd expect based on the amount of people discussing it. I'm not suggesting we eat lots of sugar, by the way, but I'm just saying from a research perspective, there's more research on high protein diets causing harm to the microbiota or ketogenic diets causing harm to the microbiota than there is on high sugar diets. And up until recently, there wasn't much stuff out there. Now there's beginning to grow. And the microbiota research has always argued the issue with the processed sugary stuff is that nothing reaches the colon. So everything's absorbed in the small intestine, leaving nothing So you don't feed any of the good guys. You just, and the bugs are like, oh, what do I eat? Oh, I'll eat a bit of you. Eat away your protective gut lining instead, because they're not being fed, you know. And they might get bits of protein that have escaped digestion, and they might get, you know, bits of bile to consume. So the ecosystem composition is poor as a result of what's not being fed rather than what is being fed. But there is some more research that's coming out on, starting to come out on higher fructose on its own, you know, and higher sucrose type diets, what impact that might have, but it's still minimal compared to where you'd imagine it to be when you read people's in the blogosphere around it. I'll just flow on because it just seems like the right time, but there's some pretty cool research that's looked at legumes and blood sugar regulation. And they've done these studies where they compared eating a big steak for breakfast and eating a bowl of legumes for breakfast and said, okay, what's the short-term blood sugar response versus what's the long-term blood sugar response? All of it was better with legumes. It was like better in the short term, even though it had, you know, carbs in it, and versus not. But for the next 24 hours, their blood sugar was much better controlled than the people that had, you know, just a chunk of meat for breakfast. And that will blow some people's minds because they totally fixed it on carbs and protein being the only thing that matters. But there's fiber and resistant starches. They matter. Yeah. And when we're eating something like legumes, they're high in those things and they're feeding butyrate producing species of bacteria in your gut. And butyrate has this amazing effect on blood sugar regulation that it actually enhances insulin sensitivity. And it really does impact how your blood sugar system, your metabolic system works. Butyrate, it's a fantastic substance. Yeah. And that's where I think the missing piece in the puzzle when we're just looking at macronutrients only and not just like protein or carb content versus you've got to look at the microbiota interaction with this too. And just like I've seen, I remember having a patient who was seeing an integrative general practitioner and they were prescribed a keto type diet, which is there's tons of duck lard and meat. I can't remember what the reason was, but this guy developed type 2 diabetes as a consequence. And his blood, you know, fats of cholesterol and triglycerides went through the roof, but his blood sugar went totally off board. And people are like, whoa, he's not eating carbs. No, but he's eating things that are actually, by eating that diet, you're taking away food for your butyrate producing species in your gut. And they go down, you're taking away food for bifidobacteria and fecalibacterium. So all those sort of beneficial bacteria go down, but you're also increasing levels of species that actually end up thriving on that kind of diet. The ones that putrefy protein, the ones that eat bile. And those ones cause worsening gut leakiness, but they also release more endotoxin into the gut, which we know actually is a core driver of blood sugar dysregulation, is endotoxins. Core driver of making your insulin not very effective. And decreasing that disinflammatory tone body-wide, which again flows on to making your blood sugar more dysregulated. You know, never mind the fact that kind of high saturated fat diet actually, saturated fat binds to these endotoxins and increases their absorption into your bloodstream. It's crazy. You know, so you're getting that, you know, the negative alterations to the gut ecosystem, plus you're increasing the absorption of the endotoxins, which are there in greater amount because because of what you're feeding your gut. And you're taking away the populations of bacteria that whose job is to heal your gut when it's damaged. Yeah. And it's a very bad combination. And in this case resulted in type 2 diabetes and, you know, major blood lipid abnormalities, which did improve when he went on to include plants into the diet once again.
Just a little casual detour down there and our minds are blown once again. Super, super cool stuff.
It's so good.
Yeah. I know time is, where we could talk for hours with you, but I'm just wondering.
Just mining your mind.
Is there one other area that you would like to take us down just briefly before we finish up?
I think the impact of microbiome modification and ASD, so kids on the spectrum, autistic spectrum disorder kids, I think just because you can see such dramatic changes with it, and you can't guarantee it, and you won't necessarily see it in 100% of patients, but you can just see some dramatic impacts on cognition, connection, your speech, where you've had, sometimes you can work, do a microbiota assessment, see what the ecosystem looks like, go, okay, take these prebiotics, make these sort of dietary changes, and like a week later, the kid tells her mom they love them for the first time ever and starts verbally talking for the first time and has eye contact. It's just like, it's mind-blowing because you never would have guessed that such a substantial shift could occur from altering the microbiota. Even me, who's got like 20 years of loving the gut microbiota, has been incorporated to our research. I was not expecting to see such dramatic shifts in that sort of time frame. It's not always that quickly or that dramatic, but it can be. And I think it's just making people keen to let people know that microbiota modification should be a consideration with kids on the spectrum, because there is the capacity for things to shift dramatically or even more minorly in terms of just more slower steps moving forward versus some kids just giant leaps. And, you know, there's some fascinating research looking at fecal microbial transplants, FMTs, in this population too, with long-standing gains. And again, on a personal level, when you're working with patients, some kids have made giant leaps, you know, in cognition and can read and communicate in ways that they couldn't, you know, even just a week before their fecal transplant, which is a much more, I would say, an interventionist and a bigger gun that I'd prefer working on microbiota optimization through diet and prebiotics and things first before doing, you know, discussing FMT type options. But it's just it just adds to that body of evidence showing how important the microbiota is and how it can actually really alter how the brain functions and your level of inflammation body wide. And I think those are key. You look at the chronic diseases we see in Westerners, they're all associated with this systemic low grade chronic inflammation, from, you know, you'd argue cancers to cardiovascular diseases to, you know, depression, anxiety, multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's, you know, all these things, rheumatoid arthritis, all linked with this. And you think, okay, well, the microbiota's got such a capacity to alter this and to be used as essentially treatment for systemic low-grade inflammation by nurturing the right group of bacteria and kind of suppressing the growth of those that are contributing to that inflammation.
Wow. So much we could talk about there, but I think I think it can help a lot of people. And I know many of us would be listening to this going, oh, I hope someone could listen to this, because obviously, yeah, autism is such a challenging thing for many people to deal with currently. And yeah, it's huge. Like it's staggering, the statistics that are coming out at the moment. So thank you so much for sharing that. So, wow, it's been such an incredible interview.
I know, and, I loved it.
It's been well worth the wait to get you on, Jason, to the show. And yeah, we really appreciate the work that you do. And thank you so much as well for being part of our upcoming Gut Immune Solution series. Like you've made an incredible contribution there as well. So watch this space if you're wondering what that is. And so if people want to learn more about you,
More education, where should they go?
They want more mind-blowing information.
More Dr. Horalak in their life.
Cool. Yeah, I've got a website called Probiotic Advisor, and we have a range of courses on there that are designed to essentially enhance people's knowledge of gut health and to treat gut conditions and gut microbiota. You know, for me, that's my passion is education around gut health and gut microbiota. So I put a lot of courses up to help people make informed decisions, both practitioners and the general public, to navigate that area. Because I think, sadly, there's a lot of great information out there online, but there's some rubbish information out there too, and it can be really challenging to navigate safely. Actually, yeah, in terms of, you know, there's lots of patients that end up being harmed by following, you know, bad advice around how to fix up your gut microbiota, or, you know, these really restricted diets that actually end up causing them harm. The symptoms get worse over time, which is sad. So I've got a passion to try to prevent that from occurring as early as possible by putting information resources out there, including doing podcasts like this, because this has a chance to reach people and actually change lives, which I think is absolutely fantastic. So thank you for doing such things too.
Well, definitely check out that resource. And yeah, it's not often, you know, we interview a lot of people, obviously, but you've got this naturopathic, you know, naturopathic doctor combined with this science
PhD well,
in this topic. So that combination, you can really tell, and how you've obviously expressed yourself so clearly and eloquently, and with good, you know, really good research behind you. So that is such a unique combination. And yeah, we really appreciate that.
Yeah. And I do want to encourage everyone that's listening to check out probioticadvisor.com. There's a, of course, as Dr. Horalak mentioned, there's a bunch of courses on there. I have a few of them, and they're just really dense, well-researched presentations, and you can tell that every line, every sentence, every slide in the slideshow is just so well researched. You know that years and years, decades of experience have gone into it, and
years of reading journals have gone into every sentence. So you know that it's good quality stuff and it's good, well worth your time. Plus there's a database of probiotics. So you can go in and check out what's this strain of probiotic and what is the science, what evidence is there for its usage. So you can find out which is best for each scenario and I guess if the marketing of something you've read is like actually accurate or not. So
yeah,
fantastic resources. So check it out, probioticadvisor.com. And thank no, you. I was not paid to make
this is not a sponsored post. This is not
a sponsored post.
Sponsored by Jason Horowitz. It sounded like it.
It did. I'm like, wow, I'm being really like gushy, but it's good.
Are you
it's
reading really like good. His transcript yeah, before the call?
Oh, thank you.
Good stuff. Good stuff.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. We can't obviously wait to hopefully have you on again at some point in the future. And thank you so much for the work you do.
Oh, you're very welcome. I'm glad to be here to share.
I think you enjoyed that one.
I did. Did you tell I was a bit fangirling at the end there?
Yeah. It was cool though. It was like you were reading off a script for his own site. Yeah.
Well, I generally, anyway, I don't need to say it again, but I do think it's a great resource. Check it out.
Now with, he came highly recommended when we first filmed the Gut Solution and we're really lucky to have him for that. And yeah, it's just super cool to just dive into someone's mind that's done this for 20 years.
Yeah.
And not only are they doing it in a clinical setting, they're also doing it in a research setting. So
yes,
it's such a unique combination and he brings so much to the table. So definitely check out his site. And if you enjoyed the podcast, leave us a comment below. That would be great. And as well, if you want to help support free content like this, give us a like and a subscribe. And if you're an auditory person only, if you're not on YouTube listening, watching right now, then please leave us a review. That really helps grow us. So if you're on iTunes or whatever your podcast provider is, leave us a review. That would be amazing. Anyway, we will see you very soon.
Thanks for joining us.